I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest is famed primatologist Franz de Waal. For 40 years, he's been writing about our relatives in the primate world, chimps and bonobos, revealing their complicated cultures and relationships strikingly similar to ours. His new book, Different, is about the diversity he's observed in these animals and how it can help us understand and embrace the diversity in our own species. There's a lot of confusion in the human world about gender, biological sex, masculinity, femininity, even pronouns. De Waal challenges many of the widely held assumptions about nature-nurture, about power, leadership, competition, cooperation, and sexual behavior. He writes, over decades of working with apes, I've known quite a few whose behavior was hard to classify as either masculine or feminine. Franz de Waal is the C.H. Candler Professor Emeritus of Primate Behavior at Emory University, former director of the Living Lynx Center, the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, and the author of now 13 books. And Franz de Waal, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah.
Let me just make sure our listeners can join us. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I hate to start an interview with a bunch of definitions, but I think if we're talking about gender and sex, that we're going to need some definitions that we all understand and agree on. Taking the word gender in your title, how should we understand what that word means?
Well, it's different from sex because sex relates to the biology, like the chromosomes and the hormones and the genitals, and we generally have two sexes. We speak of the sexual binary, even though it's not a, you know, it's like 98% or 99% binary. Now, gender is a much more complex thing because gender is the cultural pressures, the education, what you learn in your life, how we feel as a society that men and women need to behave. So gender has to do with expectations. Gender is not binary. Gender is not male, female. I'd rather call it masculine, feminine, and everything in between. So gender is a much more flexible concept. And I do speak of gender in the primates because they also have a lot of learning to do in their life. So it's not as if they only show the biological side of the duality.
And I do want to get to all of that, but I think the confusion is that we meaning I guess lay people, often sort of mix gender and sex talking about human behavior or other kinds of behavior.
That's the thing in the English language.
Must drive you crazy, right?
Yeah, in the English language we have the word sex for what is your sex and having sex. And in order to avoid that confusion, people start using the word gender inappropriately. So they say, what is the gender of your dog? Which, you know, I don't think you should be saying that, but right. That's what people say.
Right, because gender is about tradition and rituals and education, all the things you've said that sort of make us, I guess, what, unique?
Yeah, for example, we have gender reveal parties.
Yes.
Now, before birth, a baby doesn't have a gender. The fetus has no gender, has only a sex at that point, has not been exposed to our culture yet. So we confuse these two terms. Yeah.
You have spent decades studying chimps and bonobos, first chimps and then bonobos. Mm-hmm. Help us understand, I guess, what these two parts of our family have in common, and then we'll talk about their differences.
Yeah, so that's so interesting. We have two close relatives. People always compare us with chimpanzees, which is fine. They are close relatives. But the bonobos are equally close. And chimpanzees are fairly aggressive, violent, male-dominated. Bonobos are peaceful, sexy, female-dominated. So if you make the comparison, it immediately becomes a complexity. Like, you know, people who say, for example, it's natural that males are dominant, then I would say, well, you know, our close relatives don't necessarily agree with that all the time. So I think that triangular comparison is central to my book, of course. I talk a lot about humans, but also about our two close relatives. And it is more complex than people think.
When you say bonobos are sexy, what does that mean?
They have a lot of sexual activity in all combinations of individuals. I would not even call them homosexual or heterosexual. I think they're completely bisexual. They don't particularly care.
Omnisexual in a way?
Omnisexual or pansexual, we call it sometimes. So bonobos have all combinations, all sorts of positions, even positions that people cannot imagine, like They can do it hanging upside down by their feet or something, you know. They can do all sorts of things. And they have that sexual activity largely for social purposes. And that's why if you say that sex in animals is for breeding, I would say in the bonobo that's not necessarily the case. There's, I think, 3/4 of their sexual activity has nothing to do with reproduction.
Yeah. In fact, you and others call them the hippies of the primate world for that very reason.
Yeah. They're pleasure seekers also. For example, the female clitoris is the largest clitoris in the primate world, larger than in humans also. So they're pleasure seekers. But also it's important socially for them. For example, there's a lot of sex between females, and the females need to bond. The females dominate the males collectively, not individually. The female bonobo is smaller than the male. So collectively they dominate the males, and in order to do so they have to have strong bonding and sisterhood, and that's how it is. It is serviced by grooming and sex.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, again, sort of thinking about the human stereotypes about males and females, if I can use that word. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of males stereotypically as, you know, as the more sexual creature, the one that's the more sort of predatory sexual creature. Yeah. But if you look at bonobos, very different, right? It really tells a very different story.
Yeah, I think in biology in general, we have underestimated female initiative. Sometimes in the literature, it's called female promiscuity. I don't like that term because that's a negative term. But certainly female adventurism or proactivity in sexual behavior. Also for the birds, you know, the first studies that showed that females are sexually very active were the bird studies, where they looked at, with DNA technology, they started looking at the eggs and the nests of songbirds, and they found that a lot of these pairs of songbirds have eggs in their nest that are fathered by different males. So how did that happen? And initially they said there must be, these males must be going around raping females and stuff like that. But now we know that it's the females seek out males from outside, and so there's female initiative there. So it started with the birds, and now I think we have a much more a picture of female sexuality as much more active than was assumed.
You know? I'm interested in sort of, I guess, when bonobos and chimps kind of split, if we can say that, evolutionarily. Mm-hmm. How far back do we have to go?
That's like one to two million years ago. Mm-hmm. And we split off from them about 6 million years ago. So they are exactly equally close to us genetically, because we share an ancestor with their ancestor. So genetically, they're exactly equally close to us. And so people sometimes prefer one or the other. So you have people who prefer the bonobo as a comparison, or who prefer the chimp. I would say you should stop preferring these things, because they're exactly equally close to us.
And what you also say is that I guess nature doesn't choose. I mean, everything is sort of created or developed to fit its niche. So mm-hmm. chimps make sense, and so do bonobos.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and we think that actually bonobos live in a slightly different environment, and that's why they are different in their behavior. The females can travel together, so the forest has more food maybe available, and they don't need to spread out the way chimpanzees need to spread out. And since the females can travel together, they can have these strong bonds with each other, which for chimpanzee females is a bit more difficult.
So what is it like to be then a male bonobo?
Yeah, that's a sort of interesting question. Sometimes I meet men who can't stand the situation, and they say, oh, what's wrong with those males? Why don't they dominate the females and things like that? And I often ask the field workers, you know, do you think bonobo males are unhappy in their life? And they never say that, because they have a lot of sexual activity going on. They are dominated by the females, but that doesn't matter so much, because the dominance is always most important within the gender. So for a female to be dominant among females is important. For a male to be dominant among males is important. What happens between the sexes is actually, in primate life, is less important.
And then I'm thinking conversely then, so being a female chimp, what you say is a more male-dominated family.
Yeah, since chimps are more violent.
And they truly are, correct?
So bonobos don't kill each other. We don't have actual observations of one bonobo killing another one. So, but chimps do. There's quite a bit of evidence that chimps do between groups, but also sometimes within groups. And so females, the male dominance is not very gentle. And so females have a rough life, I think, in chimpanzee society.
You write about a chimp, Luit?
Yeah.
L-U-I-T?
Luit, yeah.
Luit. Who was beat up by other chimps. I mean, beat up is maybe not the correct word.
Killed. He was killed by two other males. Yeah.
Based on what caused that? And well, what does that tell us?
That's the dominant struggles among male chimps. Male chimps take that very seriously, and the whole day they're busy politicking and making coalitions. And I wrote a book, Chimpanzee Politics, which was my first book on these shenanigans of the male chimpanzees. And sometimes it turns violent. Most of the time, actually, I would say 90% of the time, they handle it without necessarily physical fights. So there's a lot of maneuvering going on. But sometimes it escalates. And in his case, he got killed by two other males.
Do we know what for? What he was killed for?
He rose to power because the existing coalition between two males fell apart. And as soon as it fell apart, he became the dominant male because they kept him under control together. And I think these two males were so extremely frustrated that they had lost their power that a couple of weeks later they got him, yeah.
Can we extrapolate then from bonobos and chimpanzees to then humans and violence and aggression?
Well, clearly, that's a big gender difference in the human species, is that you look at all the homicide statistics of any country, you're going to find more men committing homicides than women. So that is universal in the human species, and it's universal in the primates, is that the males are more physically violent than the female. I'm not saying that the females are not competitive or don't fight. Females are perfectly capable of all of that, but the killing part, that's a male thing. And so, that's one of the major differences that we see everywhere. And people can say it's due to socialization or something like that, but I don't believe that would work over the whole world for all humans everywhere, you know.
You think it's something more hardwired, or
yeah, that is
more, part of this?
That's a biological tendency, and we see that in the animal kingdom everywhere. We see males being more physically violent. Yeah.
We're almost up in a break here, but do you see then females as a kind of moderating influence within that world? Do they play that role?
Females can play that role among males. The females among themselves can be sometimes pretty nasty.
I can attest to that.
And competitive. And so to depict females as sort of angels is not, that doesn't sit well with me, because I see a lot of female competition. But the physical violence, that's more a male thing. And it's very hard to get rid of that. But I think it culturally, we can certainly suppress it. I think we have so many possibilities culturally to modify behavior. So I think we can encourage it, or we can suppress it among the men.
Yeah. Well, let's take that short break. Talking with famed primatologist Franz de Waal. He's got a brand new book. It's his 13th book, and it's called Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. We've got folks that want to join our conversation. You can join us as well. We're talking a lot about our primate family and the differences, if I can put it that way, that we see, and the things that connect us as well. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Franz de Waal about his new book titled Different. And in the book, he challenges a lot of conservative traditional assumptions about masculinity, femininity, sex identity, gender, brings some fresh ideas about this debate over nature and nurture. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. A caller couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to speak to what females can do to have more authority. And that's just really picking up on what you and I were talking about bonobos and chimps. Can we expand on that?
Yeah, so I think you need to make a distinction in the primate world, but also in the human world, between physical dominance and power. So physically, the males are bigger and stronger, and physically they dominate females in most cases, except in the bonobo. But power can be in the hands of females very clearly. Females have a hierarchy. The females are very hierarchical, also in our species. I know that people sometimes deny that, but I think our species is also very hierarchical. And you know, the word pecking order comes from hens, not from roosters. And so female hierarchies are very well known in the animal kingdom. And the top female, we call the alpha female. There's always an alpha female in a primate group, and the alpha female can have enormous power. So, for example, in bonobos, this is obvious because the alpha female is alpha over everyone, including the males. But even in chimpanzees, my previous book was about Mama, the chimpanzee, who for 40 years was alpha female. The males, there was no male who could become an alpha male without her support. So she sort of picked which male was going to be the alpha male. So that already shows a little bit of power right there. She decided a lot of group processes. And since she was for such a long time in that position, the males came and went, so to speak, during that time. So I think female leadership is easy to find in the primate world. It's really not hard to look for it. And sometimes these females have an enormous influence. And so if you ask, can females be leaders, I don't see any limitation from the primate perspective in that regard.
And certainly you can look at the human world and see many, many women who are in positions of authority. You mentioned alpha females and also alpha males. Mm-hmm. We use that phrase, I think, in a kind of negative way when talking about alpha males in the workplace and their bullying and they're difficult to deal with. You're saying that really doesn't tell the whole picture. When we talk about alpha males, it includes a lot of qualities.
I find it very unfortunate because when I wrote Chimpanzee Politics, I used the word alpha male, and the politicians in Washington, they picked that up, that term, from my chimpanzee work and started using it, and then the business world started using it in a negative way. Like, he's a real alpha male. He can beat up anyone and no one will notice. The bullying type. And they do exist in the primate world. We do sometimes have alpha males who terrorize everybody. But we also have many males who have leadership capacities, who keep order. They defend the underdog. They show empathy for others. They protect the group. And that kind of males, many of them, they can become extremely popular. And so I've known alpha males who, when they finally lost their position and became older males in the group, they became extremely popular. So they, long after their position, they still remain popular. And bullies, males who bully everybody, when they lose their position, we in captivity, we sometimes have to remove them because they are in trouble and they may get killed. And in the field, they sometimes get marginalized. They live on the edges of the territory because they are not accepted so much in the group. So being a bully in the short run may pay off, I don't know. But in the long run, I don't think it's the best possible strategy.
And I'm extrapolating to the human world based on what you just said there.
Yeah, I know you have already someone in mind, maybe.
Patty wanted to know about the distinction in non-human primates between instinct and culture. Do chimpanzees and bonobos teach their young out of instinct, or do they pass on culture? Go ahead, Franz de Waal.
Yeah, so the reason I use the word gender also for the primates is because they learn a lot of things during their lifetime. So in humans, of course, it's obvious we are adult when we're 18 or 20, so there's a very long time where we are affected by the adult environment and we learn how to behave as a man or as a woman and so on. But I think the same is true for the other primates. I usually speak of self-socialization, so it's not so much the older individuals telling the younger ones how to behave, but the young ones, and I think the same is true for humans, have a tendency to emulate the behavior of same-sex adults. Usually same sex. Actually, in transgender children, it's the opposite sex adults.
Interesting.
So the young males, they look up at males. The young females, they follow usually the example of their mother. So, for example, there's a recent study of orangutans in the forest where they found that the young females eat exactly the same diet as their mom. And there are thousands of plants there and fruits to choose from. The males, the young males, they eat a much more diversified diet because they also watch adult males and what they eat and so on. And so this self-socialization makes that you start to act like the adults of your species.
Because you're watching. I mean, it's through observation and copying. I mean, I'm thinking, again, sort of broadly speaking, the boys' roughhouse. Girls, you know, carry around dolls and teddy bears. And some people object to that, thinking, you know, where we're forcing these stereotypes on children.
Yeah, that's what people say. The people call it stereotypes. But actually, the interest in dolls and infants in young females is, I think it's not a stereotype. It's typical for the young females. So, for example, young primate females, they, as soon as there's a mother with a newborn, they surround her. They hang out with her. They try to get their hands on the baby. They want to hold the baby. And when they're inexperienced, the mother usually is very reluctant to give them the baby, of course. Hmm. But when they are more experienced, they become the babysitters. The mothers will trust them with their baby. And young males are usually not present in that crowd. They're not particularly interested in these things. In the wild, we've also seen female chimps, young female chimps, using logs and rocks as a sort of doll. They carry it on their back, or they carry it on their belly. They build nests for them. So they make dolls out of nothing, like human girls can do that too. And so I think the interest in infants and dolls is something that we see in many female primates.
And I wonder too about, you know, then the ability of, and I'm feeling like the words masculine and feminine don't apply in our conversation, but nonetheless, let's say a father can be a nurturing parent, right?
Yeah, that's another misconception that people have, is that nurturing kids is not something for the males. And I've even heard conservative radio shows making fun of paternity leave. Why would you need paternity leave? It's the man who don't take care of the kids, you know. I think that's nonsense. Even in chimps and bonobos, where the males normally do very, very little, apart from protecting, they do very little with the young ones. If there is an orphan, if a mother dies, and all of a sudden there's an orphan who's calling out for help, it's very often adult males who adopt them. And not just for 2 days. They adopt them sometimes for many years, and they carry them on their back, and they take care of them, and they wait for them when they travel, and they protect them. So caring for kids is something that the males can do, and they have a tendency to do if it's necessary. And that's in our close relatives. I think humans are even more prone to do that, because we evolved nuclear families where males are involved in the care of a family. And so I think we are even more prone to do that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and make sure our listeners can join our conversation. Again, talking with primatologist Franz De Waal. He's written now 13 books, and his newest one we're talking about is called Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. And it covers a lot of territory related to primate behavior. We are primates, us humans. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Tom has a question. Do bonobos have a sense of fairness in social interactions, either for sex or sharing foods, etc.? Fairness, he put in quotations.
Yeah, we have done studies on fairness, not specifically with the bonobos, but we've done studies where we give different rewards to different primates for the same task. So, for example, we put two monkeys side by side, and they can do a task, and one of them get grapes for the task, the other one get cucumbers for the task, and grapes are so much better than cucumbers. And the one who gets cucumber, normally they're perfectly willing to work for that kind of food, but if the neighbor gets grapes, then they become angry and they reject that. And so we speak of a sense of fairness in the primates nowadays, that they are sensitive to reward distribution. And yes, in a primate group, there is usually quite a bit of food sharing. Bonobos are interesting in that regard, because they usually have sex when food comes in, for example, in captivity when the zoo provides food to them, or in the wild when they enter a big fruit tree where there's a lot of food available. They usually have first sex and then they share the food.
Then a meal?
The sex sort of smooths the relationships and makes it possible for them to be more tolerant, yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Here's a question.
Very hippie-like.
Yeah, I was going to say very hippie-like. Helen from Rose Valley says, is it possible that humans tilt towards our bonobo ancestors because we live in urban environments? Bonobos live close together like humans. Are we more bonobo than we are chimp, or do we have to choose?
We don't have to choose. You know, the bonobo has something that we are a very sexual primate also. Very obsessed
by
sex. Yeah, we don't talk every day about it, but it, yeah, it's very obsessed. So in that sense, we have sexual relationships. We have female bonding, clearly, in our societies. And so in that regard, we are very bonobo-like, I would say. But the male bonding, the bonobo males are not particularly good at friendships and bonding. Whereas chimpanzee males, apart, they have all this competition, but at the same time they are friends and hang out together and groom each other and stuff like that. That's a very male chimpanzee thing, and I think human male bonding is also real and important. Sometimes, you know, I'm a biologist who works in a psychology department. And I know the psychologists downplay the male bonding. They hype the female bonding. Females are wonderful with each other, but men, you know, they are too competitive. And I don't agree with that. I'm from a family of six boys. I've always been surrounded by men. I think it's a bit insulting of the psychologists to do as if men friendships don't mean anything. I think they have a lot of meaning for men.
I agree.
And so I take man friendships very seriously, and I think we humans are a male-bonded species and a female-bonded species at the same time.
Talk to us about this chimp named Donna, who you describe as a largely asexual, gender non-conforming individual.
Yeah.
So this is fascinating.
So Donna, I've known since she was two or three, which in chimpanzee terms is really young when they're still, you know, they're still nursing at that time. Mm-hmm. And so when she was very young, she would play with the adult males in the group. So the alpha male, for example, she would approach him and wrestle with him. Now, that's something that the males don't usually do with young females. The males love to wrestle with young males and test their strengths on them and stuff like that. But the young females, they sort of ignore in that regard. And the young males are also much more eager to wrestle than the young females. Now, but Donna was different. Donna, already at that young age, she acted a bit like a young male. And then later she grew into a very male-like female. She, her genitals were clearly female, but her body built and all her long hair that she had and the way she walked and the way she hung out with males was very male-like, very masculine. She hung out with the males. She, when the males were displaying and intimidating the group, she went along with that. And so she acted more like a male almost, and from a distance she looked almost like a male than like a female. And I cannot ask her gender identity, so or her pronouns. I cannot do that. But I bet she identified very much with males, more than with females.
So picking up on that, from the world of animal primates, then I guess we're an animal too, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of non-human primates, then we can see ourselves reflected in terms of people who identify as transgender, for instance. Is that what you're referencing here?
Yeah, I think there's an enormous variability. We biologists, of course, are used to variability. Like there's no trees of the same species that are identical. So we're very used to individual variability. Each individual has its own characteristics. And that's why I sometimes am a bit upset that in our society we don't appreciate that variability. We want to put everyone in boxes. You are a man, you're a woman, you are a homo, you're a hetero. And we have all these boxes in which you have to fit. But that's not how biology really – and that's the biological side of sex. The biology is not even simple. So then if you go to the cultural side of how what we teach children and how to behave and so on, that's even more flexible and there's even more variation there.
Well, let me quote Kinsey, who you quote in your book, and a couple of sentences here. He writes, males do not represent two discrete populations, heterosexual and homosexual. The world is not to be divided into sheep and goats. Not all things are black, nor all things white. It is a fundamental of taxonomy, that nature rarely deals with discrete categories. Only the human mind invents categories and tries to force facts into separated pigeonholes. I circled that and underscored that because I thought that was so important. I mean, he was studying human sexuality and came to this conclusion.
It's funny that he mentioned sheep in that
he does, sheep
in that story, because now we have evidence. Most of the time we say, homosexual behavior is found in the animal kingdom, and the primates show a lot of homosexual behavior, but you don't find exclusive homosexuality usually. But sheep are an exception. So rams and ewes, is that the word?
Ewes.
Okay, rams and ewes. In the rams, we find, I believe, 10 to 12% of the males is very focused on other males sexually, much more than on females. And so he mentioned sheep without knowing that in the end we have now studies showing that there's quite a bit of homosexual behavior there.
Yeah, he was quite a visionary. But this impulse, this human impulse to think of the world divided into these two binaries, I mean, is there an explanation for that?
Well, we are a symbolic species, so we label. We love to label. And the primates don't have that tendency. And so you don't need to fit in a box necessarily. Mm-hmm. And in the primates, the interesting thing to me is that we see quite a bit of this gender variability. So we see also, for example, males who don't play the macho game and don't want to become the dominant male and stay out of all these confrontations. So we have quite a bit of variability, but I never noticed that that there is intolerance to that. It's not as if the others are upset by that's just how that individual is, and they deal with it, you know?
Almost, I'm going to break here, but I think you write about a bell curve. I mean, when looking at, I guess, what sexuality or gender
differences,
it looks like a bell curve.
Yeah, that means that you have the averages are different,
right?
But there's a lot of overlap. So, for example, the average man is taller than the average woman. But we all know some women who are taller than most men, and the opposite, some men who are shorter than most women. So that's what's called the bell curves, is that the averages are different, but there's an enormous amount of overlap.
And that is Frans de Waal, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. He's a professor emeritus of primate behavior. That's at Emory University. Also former director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, both in Atlanta, Georgia, or outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with primatologist Frans de Waal about his latest book called Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. He's written 13 books, including Chimpanzee Politics. That was his first book. Bonobo, the Forgotten Ape, Our Inner Ape, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Mama's Last Hug, among other books. Let me play a clip, and this is going to seem kind of jarring, but I want to play it for our guest, Frans de Waal. This is former NFL player, current Georgia Senate GOP candidate Herschel Walker, pushing back on evolutionary scientists. This is at an appearance at Sugar Hill Church in Georgia. This was last month, March 13th, talking with Pastor Chuck Allen.
And I'll tell you something else I heard. Now, think about this, because at one time, science said man came from apes. Did it not?
Every time I read or hear that, I think to myself, you just didn't read the same Bible I did.
Well, this was interesting, though. If that is true, why are there still apes? Think about it.
You know, now you're getting too smart for us.
No. Think about this. We have an evolution that is, we've gotten so intelligent that if that is true, why are there still apes?
I want to put that to you, Francois, but let me read a Facebook comment from Richard related to this. And he says, comparing primates to humans is comparing apples and oranges. Humans were made male and female in the image of God. Chimps are different from humans. So I'm going to toss both of those things right at you.
All right. Well, male and female, of course, has to do with sexual reproduction, which we share with all sorts of animals and even with plants. And sexual reproduction requires this distinction. So it's you can put God in that equation, but I think it is present in so many species. And Herschel Walker, you know, I live in Georgia, so we're very proud of his opinion here. It's a very strange, I think it's a very weak argument against evolution because, you know, for example, dogs descend from wolves, but the wolves are still around. Mammals descend from reptiles, and the reptiles are still around. There's really no good logical reason why you cannot descend from something and that other species would have to disappear. I don't know where that argument comes from, but it's a very weak argument against evolution.
I remember doing shows, I mean, several decades ago, frankly, when, you know, mm-hmm. evolution was this hot button issue and there were debates and we don't teach it in school. Uh-huh. Are we at a different place now? From your perspective?
I would hope so. I think there is an increasing acceptance of evolution among people, even though the school system in the U.S. is still pretty deficient in supporting the idea. Of course, in biology, it's not a question. It's not a question that we debate. For us, evolution is a fact.
Right.
It's so well established. It's a bit like gravity. Gravity you cannot see, but we assume it, and it's well supported by all sorts of evidence. And the same thing is true for evolution. Evolution is hard to see, but there's plenty of evidence to support the idea.
You also, I mean, there are a lot of enduring beliefs, not believed by everybody, but this notion that somehow males and females have a different place in our sort of superiority hierarchy, the idea that males are somehow superior to females. Some people still believe that.
Yeah.
In spite of what I would say the evidence.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That's the argument over the centuries has always been men are smarter than women. Men are more intellectual. Women are more like children. They have emotions that the men don't deal with. And that has always been the traditional argument. And now that we live in a time where boys and girls get very similar or maybe identical education, these differences, these intellectual differences are disappearing. So it's very hard now to spot them, actually. And if you would test university students, men and women, I bet you're not going to find much of a difference anywhere in intellectual capacities. You may find there are certain subcapacities, like mental rotation. There are certain subcapacities that seem to vary by gender, but general intelligence, no. And I think that whole argument is falling apart at this moment because now finally education is catching up with us, you know.
What's mental rotation? I mean, are you saying
spatial orientation.
Okay. Yeah. And does one sex have a different
yeah,
have an advantage?
males seem to have an advantage. Females seem to have an advantage in early vocabulary, speaking more words at an early age. So yeah, there are certain of these gender differences, and you sometimes see them in the literature. And I'm not a specialist on this. I don't know how strong they are, but they are often mentioned.
Here's some more questions. I think we touched on this, but one of our listeners wants to know, so do female bonobos have sex with other females? And you said, correct.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's actually, there's evidence from certain studies that the females are more affected by sex with each other. They're emotionally more affected by it than with males. They do these studies where they collect oxytocin from the urine samples, and oxytocin is the cuddle hormone, and that rises more in females after sex with females than with males. And so they seem to be emotionally more affected by sex with their own sex.
In fact, you have a drawing in the book of two female bonobos having sex, and they look very happy, big smiles on their faces.
Yeah, that's another thing, is that we have good evidence for orgasm in females, and as I mentioned before, the females have a large clitoris, and they squeal during sex, and so yeah, there seems to be quite a bit of excitement going on. Yeah.
You challenged Freud on that.
Yeah, Freud, he gave us the vaginal orgasm.
Right.
And he poo-pooed the clitoral orgasm, which he thought was ridiculous and infantile. And we now know that you know the clitoris is really the center of the female orgasm. That's also the female clitoris has as many nerve endings in it that serve pleasure, as in the penis of the male. And there are certain species, and I don't think it's accidental, that the dolphin has the biggest clitoris, the female, and the bonobo has a very big clitoris in the primate world. I don't think it's accidental that these species that engage in a lot of sexual activity, sexual activity, that those are the same species that have a large clitoris.
Oh, yeah. And are female dominated, would that be the word too?
Female dominated, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, in the bonobos, this is sort of a female-centric species,
yeah.
Correct?
No, the dolphins, the females are not dominant over males, but the dolphins do a lot of what they call petting. They come up with these terms that avoid the word sex. Dolphins do, you know, people are very shy about sex. I think one of the things is that I'm from a country where we are much less shy in the Netherlands. So that may have affected also the way I write this book, because, for example, homosexual behavior in the Netherlands has been legal for more than two centuries. And so I was surprised when I came to this country that I had to fill out paperwork saying that I was not a communist and I was not a homosexual. Sort of interesting.
You came to America, you had...
Yeah, that was in the 1980s. You had to declare that you were not a homosexual.
In the 1980s?
Yeah.
I'm absorbing that. Yeah.
It sounds ages ago, but, it's not so long ago.
Let me read a tweet from Joan. Cross-cultural variation exists in terms of gender categories. A few cultures have three or four categories. Not all cultures categorize gender into only binaries. And, I mean, this is part of the thesis of your book. Correct?
Yeah, that's the beauty. That's why I'm never saying that language is the source of the intolerance. Because language, I think, can make you intolerant. You say people are black, people are white, people are homo, people are hetero. So language can serve intolerance, but the intolerance itself comes from other sources, because there are languages that have more room, that have, like she explains, that include a third gender or another category. Yeah.
Here's an email from Tony. Can you comment on the conversation's tendency to move seamlessly from understanding bonobos and chimpanzees to diagnosing human behavior? You emphasize that we are genetically similar, but given that, is any and every extrapolation okay? Do you follow guidelines in this regard? I think she's saying, how much can we extrapolate from bonobos and chimps to human beings?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's exactly extrapolating, because I think it's a comparison, a triangular comparison. Our two closest relatives, they're also cultural beings, they're also biological beings, and that's the comparison. And so I don't necessarily extrapolate, because humans have a few unique characteristics.
Sure.
One of them is, for example, that we have nuclear families. So males are involved in the care for family, much more so than male chimpanzees or male bonobos. And that makes the equation quite a bit different for humans. Humans also are a very smart species, and so we are even more culturally influenced, I would say, than they are, the other primates. So there are certain differences that we need to keep in mind. The sexual dimorphism of the human species, the size difference between male and females, is a bit smaller than in bonobos and chimpanzees. And then we have, of course, other primates, like, let's say, the gorilla, where it's enormous, the difference. And if these sex differences get very big, it's called sexual dimorphism, if it gets very big, then you get a totally different dynamic between the males and the females.
Just because of sheer size?
Yeah.
What that means.
Yeah, because the first studies that were reported were on baboons, where in baboon the males are twice the size of females and have enormous canine teeth. And the first studies in primatology, they emphasized this baboon model to compare us with, which for gender studies is really not the greatest model, I would say. I think we are much closer to chimps and bonobos in that regard.
Talk about nature and nurture, and you talk about yourself as your philosophy or your approach is interactionist.
Yeah.
That, I mean, we don't have to choose, correct?
Yeah, that's the thing, is that people want to choose. And so there are people who say men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and men are totally different in their brains and in their behavior from women. So there's this group. And then there's another group, let's say in the gender studies programs, where they sort of downplay all the differences and say, well, it's all socialization. Basically, men and women are very similar, only between the legs is different. And those are the two extreme positions. And I'm a biologist and an interactionist. I believe that culture and biology always interact. You cannot take the one away from the other. You cannot say, for example, gender is independent from sex. I don't think that's a possibility. Gender and sex are always fused one way or another. So there's always an interaction between the cultural environment and your biology. You cannot tease them apart.
You write about being, I think you're a college student, and being part of this club, MVM club. What was that about? And how does that factor into our conversation here?
Yeah. As a child, I was surrounded by men. I'm from a family of six boys, and I went to a boys' schools and so on. So I was surrounded by males. And as a result, I was curious about gender. When I reached college and saw a lot of girls, all of a sudden, I was interested in that. And I joined this feminist movement. It wasn't called feminist, it was called emancipation at the time. Mm-hmm. I joined
this.
So is
this the 60s?
70s.
70s, yeah. Okay.
So I joined this movement and I stayed for 1 year in it. Their goal was to have men and women work together to change the gender roles. And I was interested in that issue, and I'm very supportive of that concept. But they became increasingly hostile to men. Men were not really welcome anymore, and that's when I left the club.
Yeah. Help us understand your interest, and this goes back decades now, your interest in the world of primates.
Well,
when did that start?
I'm interested in animals in general. As a child, I always had animals and I was surrounded by animals. And I think the primates is sort of secondary, is an offshoot of that. I was also interested in birds and fish. I still have a lot of fish at home. So, and in all these species, you see very interesting things as far as sex is concerned. For example, in fish, there are fish who start life as females and end life as males, you know. They exist. There are remarkable things that happen in nature. Yeah.
So part of it was just that nature is just full of these amazing questions and creatures.
Yeah. And I try to answer in this book mostly based on the primates, of course. I want to stick to the primates. But if you look wider in nature, there's all sorts of interesting things going on.
Do you think, this is about humans, but do you think there's a lot of confusion and a lot of arguments about gender and identity and orientation? Do you think We're at an important juncture.
Yeah, I can't stand the intolerance that occurs. I don't understand why you would be intolerant towards a particular group of people. But that is happening also in the discussion. But I think behind that discussion is also a lot of mystery. People are mystified by what is the biology that is behind gender. Can we extract gender from biology? I don't think you can. And people are very curious about that question, which part of it is biological and which part is not. And I try to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean, indeed you do. But I think it's an interesting time where we know a lot more about biology and sex and gender. And so trying to put all the pieces together can be challenging.
Yeah. And for example, the transgender question, there's also a biological side to this. There are studies on the brain that indicate that in the brain of, let's say, trans women, they have a brain that looks more female-like than that of many men. And so there are brain studies on this, and I'm not delving into brain because I'm not a neuroscientist, but there is a biological side to that as well.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. As always, Frans de Waal, a pleasure having you on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
Lots to talk about, think about. And again, Frans de Waal has been our guest. He's got a new book. It's called Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. He is Professor Emeritus of Primate Behavior at Emory University actually former director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, and this is his 13th book. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs, and you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.